what we're going to be talking about in this 8-week study. But we're in the second week, and we went through the introduction last time. We know this is an epistle written to Titus, a young evangelist. And what's really interesting is the very first thing that we're going to see in this letter to this young evangelist is this section on qualifications for elders. Now, normally, when we look at this passage, we're not looking at it in its context. And by that, I mean, normally we take this passage by itself to simply talk about qualifications for elders. We use that in 1 Timothy 3 and we couple those together. I think if we want to understand these qualifications better, then we really need to understand the context better and why Paul's writing this to Titus. We're going to see some of that. And we are going to talk about a lot of these qualifications tonight. But what we're going to see is this whole discussion of the eldership is put here for a specific purpose, because this is the whole reason Titus was left behind in Crete. Is there's a problem. He is supposed to set up a solution to this problem, and we'll discuss that this evening and into next week as well. But to begin with, when we look at verse 5, we're given the purpose, not just for this letter, but we're really given the purpose for why Titus is where he is in the first place. Because Paul says, "This is why I left you in Crete," which, by the way, we talked about last time. What does that imply about Paul after he got out of prison in his first imprisonment? Yeah, that he had gone to Crete at some point in his journeys, in his travels. We know that he went to Ephesus. We know that he went to Macedonia. We know that he went to Crete. So he says, "This is why I left you in Crete, so that you might put what remained into order and appoint elders in every town as I directed you." Now, in the English, and when I looked at this, just looking at the way this is translated in English, this made me think along a different, you know, line than I think the Greek actually meant. And this is how I originally read that, although this isn't a wrong conclusion. When he says, "put what remains in order," that kind of seems to imply that there has been some kind of a fallout or something that has taken place, and that those that were perhaps there when Paul was there are no longer there anymore. And so he's saying, you take what remains, what's left over, and you put it into order. That was what I originally thought that would mean, and that's not a wrong conclusion, as we'll see in the context, but it's not exactly what Paul's saying here. This word "remains" really literally means what is lacking or what is absent. And so what Paul is telling Titus is, you take what is lacking or what is absent, what isn't present within the churches, and you put it into order. Now, what is Paul telling Titus then? What is lacking in every single one of these churches on the island of Crete, apparently? There's no elders. They had gone through and they had established churches, and there were new Christians and new works and new converts, but there were no elders in any of these churches, all right? Now, when you have no leadership and no elders, let's do some forward thinking. What is going to be really easy to take, or what could happen easily in a group with no leadership? Go ahead.
A strong personality is going to take over.
Right. Someone with a strong personality can either take over and lead a group a way that they sometimes should go, but oftentimes, more than not, a way that they shouldn't go. Yeah, Bruce.
I was going to say, it opens the door for the Jewish segment of that, to which is really strong, well-founded, to say, you know, really, we do need to circumcise, and we need...
Okay.
And so those issues are going to come up there.
Okay, good. Yeah.
And more specifically, it leaves a door open for Satan.
Perfect. Perfect. So let's just think critically here for a minute as we look at that. Remember, what's been the problem in the book of Acts as Paul's been going along his journey? Who's always following him and causing trouble? It's the Judaizing teachers that are teaching that you have to keep the law and be circumcised as Gentiles. Everywhere Paul went, that's the problem that he had. That's what primarily what the book of Acts is really about, is this issue and how the church dealt with it in the first century and this transition period that took place. Well, it's happening here at Crete. And you can imagine, as a Gentile that doesn't know much about the law and that is really new in the faith, would the Jews sound very persuasive when they came in with their vast knowledge of the law as they come in and start to teach? I mean, absolutely. And so what they need is sound leadership to deal with this issue. I want to skip over the qualifications and see how what Paul is saying here is, Titus, here's the problem. I left you there to set up elders, to appoint elders in every town to deal with this issue. Because if you skip through the qualifications, verse 5 reads right into verse 10. He says, this is why I left you in Crete, so that you might put what remained in order and appoint elders in every town as I directed you. For there are many who are insubordinate, empty talkers, and deceivers, especially those of the circumcision party. They must be silenced, since they are upsetting whole families by teaching for shameful gain what they ought not to teach. Now, when he says they must be silenced, put it together with verse 5. How are these Judaizing teachers going to be silenced? By strong leadership in the church, by the elders. It wasn't Paul that can go back and do all the work. He wasn't telling Titus to go around and silence all these teachers, because Titus is like Paul. Within a few years, where is Titus going to be? Somewhere different. He needs to establish strong, sound leadership in every group if they're going to survive and the churches are going to exist the way they should there. And this is the response. This is how they're going to be silenced, is through elders. And that, by the way, we'll look at this more next week, but when he says they're upsetting whole families, we use that word so different in the English. When, you know, if I drop my coffee, I'm upset, right? Or if the Ducks lose, I'm upset. Aren't I, Bruce? No, Bruce isn't. But that's not what that word there means. That word upsetting means to destroy. He's saying these teachers are coming through and they are destroying whole families. Their spiritual welfare is being destroyed. They're leaving the church by the families. And you can see the urgency for leadership here in Paul's voice. Whole families are leaving because they're being persuaded by these false teachers. And so we've got to do something about it, and we've got to do something about it right now. And that's why Paul is writing this to Titus. So the answer is going to be this role of an elder. And we've looked at this before when we've talked about the purpose of elders and the role of elders here very recently. But when we talk about the elder, there's really these three words that are used to describe an elder primarily that kind of give it its job description. The first one is an elder, which the word there in the Greek, presbyteros, is really the idea of an older man. But the implications of that is not just someone who's old, but someone who is also mature in their faith and in their walk. Yeah, Wayne.
Is that the first one, is that the presbyter?
Yes, and that's the word that's translated elder there. So there's that. There's episkopos, which is where the word Episcopalian comes from, and that is the word for overseer. And then the third one is the Greek word for shepherd. And all of these really help to help us to understand the role and the purpose of the eldership. They are those who are the elders. They're mature in the faith. They're like those father-like figures in the church. They're also the overseers, which is really translated a guardian or a superintendent. It's interesting that here in Titus, how he's going to say this in verse 6. Nope, not verse 6. Verse 7. As an overseer, he also calls him God's steward. Now, if you look at the idea of a steward, someone who is a steward And again, here's my nerd coming out. I always use Lord of the Rings references. They're just too good. You know, in The Return of the King, I'm going there again, you've got the steward of Gondor. He's not the king. He is only there to temporarily take the place until the king comes back. The elders are called the stewards of God's church. They're there to help lead and shepherd the church until who comes back? Until Jesus. But there are these guardians, these overseers, and their job is to act as shepherds for the church. We see that word in 1 Peter 5:2, where Peter himself identifies himself as an elder and a shepherd of the church. And the idea behind being a shepherd is this care and this concern and protection as well. When wolves came into the flock, whose job was it to get rid of the wolves? It's the shepherd. And we see that language all throughout the Old Testament. They would have been so familiar with this. We aren't so familiar with shepherd language today because that's just not our culture. But in the context, what Paul is calling Titus to do is to elect protectors and guardians over the churches because they're under attack in Crete right now. And so this is very urgent what he's talking about. And they're going to have to be men that are going to be able to be very different than what you see the Judaizing teachers doing. They're these men who are teaching for dishonest gain things that they ought not to teach, as we'll see in verse 11. But here he says, they must hold firm to the trustworthy word as taught, so that he may be able to give instruction in sound doctrine and also rebuke those who contradict it. He says, these men need to be able to be adequate in taking care of this problem that's arisen with the Judaizing teachers. They need to be able to refute them, and in turn, they need to be able to teach what is accurate and what is correct. This is the solution to the problem that's taking place right there. And that kind of begs us to ask the question, we'll look at this a little bit more later, but each group needs to look and ask, who is actually leading the church? Because far too often when you look at the Christian world in general, who is generally looked at as the leader of a church and who directs them? It's the preacher. Who is supposed to be the leaders of the church? The elders. And if it's not the shepherds, if it's not the elders, then we're not doing it God's way. And in fact, that model falls apart. I was talking to Scott Beyer this week about an instance I'd already relayed to you guys in the past. Recently, there was a group here in Salem. I believed it was a Baptist group. Several of my friends went there. And the head pastor was caught in some kind of scandal and had to step down. And the comments from all the kids and all the members were that they're going to shut down the doors to the church in the next 3 months. And the reason for that was because they couldn't survive without him. It was all built on this one man, not in the organization that God had designed, and therefore their church was failing and falling apart. Not the way it's supposed to be. Now, I did this test on Clinton this afternoon. We met for lunch and we're doing some things. We always talk about qualifications for elders. And a lot of times we look at these qualifications as these special things that need checkmarked as we're going through and trying to decide who is going to go into the office of elder. And so we take 1 Timothy 3 and we take Titus 1 and we put them together and we make a list. We've done it, haven't we? And you go through and look at each of these things and which man, you know, falls into these categories. There's nothing necessarily wrong with that. But what I want us to do is be able to hopefully tonight reshape the way we even think about qualifications. Now, let's do a little bit of an experiment. What I want to argue is that these qualifications are not so much these special things that God has set aside so much as they are common sense. Things that we should have known in the first place. And this is important in understanding a question that a lot of people have. Because let's just talk about what you expect of people in leadership, period. So, if you were going, and I want some participation here, What are characteristics that you would expect of someone that you were going to vote for as President of the United States? Go ahead.
Respectable.
What's that?
Respectable.
Okay, respectable.
Honest.
Wise. Okay, wise.
Integrity.
What else?
Integrity.
Okay, integrity. What else?
Knowledgeable.
Knowledgeable. We're all talking about presidents here, right?
Even-tempered.
Even-tempered, okay. What about even like CEOs, right?
Well-spoken.
What's that?
Well-spoken.
Well-spoken, okay. What else?
Trustworthy.
All right, trustworthy. I heard something else.
Somebody that's a little older.
Okay, older. You're not going to put a four-year-old in charge of the United States. Okay, not an 18-year-old either. Good. All right, what else? Restraint?
That they don't jump into
things. Oh, okay. Okay, so restraint, not angry. Okay. All right. Now, Ian, go ahead.
Proven history.
All right.
Proven history.
Good track record, right? Now, let me ask this question. Where did you guys come up with this list? You... Life. These are, David.
I was going to say core values.
Okay. But these are just things, core values, that you would naturally expect of someone that is going to lead a group of people. Someone that is in a position of authority, in a position of influence, in a position of leadership. These are natural qualities that you would expect someone to do or to be seen. Okay. So that is going to kind of change. This is how I want us to see a lot of these qualifications, because I guarantee you there's some things that might get us to think different about whether or not a man should go into the position of elder that you might not explicitly read in the text. And let's explain how we can even get there biblically to understand what we mean. There's no qualifications like this for a president, and that's very obvious when you see the kind of people that run for president, right? Oftentimes, the things you would hope to see in a leader are not present in that person's life or in that individual's life, and yet they have lots of people to vote for them. But these are just things that we naturally come to, things that are common sense that we expect of people in a leadership position. That's going to help us answer this question, because a lot of people ask, why are the lists different to Timothy than to Titus? Because if there's things on the list to Timothy that weren't included in the list to Titus, would that mean that perhaps there were men that were appointed in Crete that weren't qualified had they read what was said to Timothy? Do you get that question? Some people actually have a problem with this. They really do. That we have a different list, and so we have an issue. Okay, no. We don't have any issue. One, because they don't contradict each other, but rather, they complement one another. When you read 1 Timothy 3 and when you read Titus 1, most of what they say are the same thing. A lot of it said in just different words. Some the exact same words. And we need to remember, Paul is going to have a heavy emphasis on protection and teaching for the church in this context. This list is going to be a little different because Paul is writing to Titus for a specific reason. And there is a specific issue that needs to be addressed here. And yes, he's going to talk about the kind of men who are qualified to fit this position, but he's got an axe to grind in some ways on the why he is writing what he is writing. But here's the biggest thing. We can gather much of the same expectations naturally, though not stated in the other list. For example, in Titus, it does not say what it does in 1 Timothy 3 when it says, if he cannot govern his own house, then how can he govern the house of God? But when you read the list in Titus and says that he must be a husband to one wife and have believing children, not subject to the charge of insubordination or debauchery, can you still get the same point that Paul makes in Timothy when you read what you read in Titus? It's just it's a general understanding. You can still come to the same conclusion, primarily because of what each of these lists is going to start with. And here's how I want us to frame our understanding of these qualifications. All of these qualifications are going to really fall under one overarching principle for qualifying a man to be an elder. Each one of these lists starts with this statement. If anyone is above reproach, and in Titus that's going to be repeated immediately again in verse 7. In 1 Timothy 3, that's how this list begins. Therefore, an overseer must be above reproach. Then in each of these lists, this idea of being above reproach is then elaborated on what some of those things that someone who is above reproach should have or should not have in their life. But we should not look at this as an exhaustive list. For example, when he says above reproach, that's this word for being unaccused, irreproachable, or blameless. Are there some Old Testament characters that pop up in your mind when you hear this? Someone who's blameless, or someone who was above reproach, someone who they couldn't find any fault with them, anything wrong with them. Daniel. When you read Daniel 6, the satraps and the presidents are trying to find something with Daniel, and it says they could find no fault with him. They inspected him. They were trying to find something against him or against his character. That's the same thing that's going on in these presidential debates, isn't it? All the media is digging to try to find something wrong with their character, whether it's Hillary or Trump or Johnson or that guy who wears a boot on his head who runs every year. Seriously, look him up. It doesn't matter, but everyone is trying to find something wrong with their character, something that makes them reproachable. Here, Daniel, it said that Daniel was above reproach. That's the same language used of an elder. This man is supposed to be above reproach. Now, does that mean that this man is sinless? Okay, we know that. No, that is not what that means. But we're talking about someone whose walk and practice in their life is to serve God and to be righteous. That when you think of this person, the first thing that you think about is that they're holy and blameless. That when you inspect their life, you can't really come up with anything that brings reproach on them or the household of God. And if that's the case, these are the kinds of things then that you should see in their life. They should be above reproach in regards to their relationship to God and their understanding of His Word. They should be above reproach when it comes to their family life. That's the biggest thing that people try to tackle when they're trying to come up with something against someone, especially in presidential races, right? They'll come up with some kind of scandal about what they, you know, so-and-so did with so-and-so way back in the day, or some recording, you know, there's that thing about Trump going around and what he said on this interview so long ago. But what about their family life? Is their family life above reproach? What about just to themselves, their character? Is their character above reproach? What about in their relationships to other people, not their family, but to the community? Is their relationship in regards to the community above reproach? At work, in their personal friendships? What about to things? Like whether it's alcohol or whether it's these different types of addictions. Do they have addictions or are they above reproach in that sense? You see, all of these things can kind of be really bundled under this overarching principle that an elder is supposed to be someone who is above reproach. And all of these qualifications then fall under that understanding of a man who is above reproach looks like this. And that's where we come up with this list that you see in Titus and that you see in Timothy. And here's what I mean about it not being necessarily exhaustive. Let's say there was a man in the church who was a husband to one wife and raised godly children and all these things, but every single year he filed for bankruptcy because he did not honor the Lord with his money or because he had a gambling addiction. Do you see anything in qualifications for elders that specifically says something about being wise with their money? Okay, you see self-control and disciplined. Are there going to be areas that you need to use common sense to look at and say, this man would not qualify for such a position because he did not demonstrate self-control in these areas of his life? That's what I mean when I say this isn't necessarily an exhaustive list, because there are some characteristics that are going to play over all sorts of areas that we need to be wise in looking at and thinking about in regards to people's lives. You can't just go down this checklist. You have to explore those because there's hands off of some of these things for us to think about, for us to consider. Now, that being said, let's look at what is said in the text. And the first qualification that you see under being above reproach in each of these lists is that an elder is to be a husband of one wife. What is that automatically, or who does that automatically eliminate from being an elder? What's that? Okay, a bigamist would be one. A polygamist would be another. Someone who's single would be another. We're missing a big one. Women, okay? This automatically means that those who are going to be in a position of leadership in the role of an elder in the church is going to fall on someone who is a man. Now, does that mean that women are not important in the church? Everyone say no. Different roles. But this role is to be fulfilled by a man who is not married to two women, who is not sleeping around with other women. This literally means a one-woman man, okay? He's not a polygamist. He's not an adulterer. He is a one-woman man. Now, when people read this, anytime you put an apple in the center of the room, there's going to be an argument about it, okay? And there are all sorts of debates about this because let's say an elder is an elder and he's a one-woman man, but then his spouse dies. Is he any longer qualified to be an elder? Because it says that he's to be the husband of one woman. And then again, if he, let's say his wife dies, but he remarries, and the argument is he's no longer a one-woman man, but he is a two-woman man because he's had two wives. And there is all sorts of debate about this. These questions can be answered when we go back to using our brains, okay? And I don't want to say that to be insulting to those who get involved in these debates, but let's just think about this for a moment. These qualifications all fall under this category of someone who is above reproach, okay? Now let me ask you this question. If a man's spouse, a man who is an elder, and his spouse dies, he didn't kill her, okay? But she just dies. And he marries in the Lord another. What reproach has he brought upon himself or the church? Has he done anything sinful or wrong? The reason these qualifications are put there is to steer someone in the direction of someone who is above reproach. That kind of action is not something that brings reproach upon the church, okay? Yeah, Kevin, go ahead.
Under that same line of thinking, couldn't someone who's never been married be above reproach?
Yes, but God intentionally gives these requirements for someone who is married, has been a one-woman man, a husband, and has raised godly children. And I think the answer for that is going to come from 1 Timothy 3, that if he cannot manage his own household, then he can't manage the church. Can someone who is single and above reproach in their single life, what's their own household? Just themselves, right? They don't have any experience in raising godly children. But the requirement for being a one-woman man is to get children. What do you have to have? You have to have a wife, and you have to be married, and you have to work that relationship out and make it a godly marriage, and you have to work out your children and make them godly children, right? But when you look at this argument, and some of them say, well, no, he's a two-woman man, okay? Well, time out. When you look at what Paul says in 1 Corinthians 7 to widows, and he says that it's better just to remain as I am, but if you remarry, you have not sinned, but do it in the Lord, right? Now, here's my question. How many husbands does that widow have if she marries a man in the Lord? Are you sure? Because when they make this argument, well, now they have two spouses. Well, what does that now make them? It makes them an adulterer or a bigamist or a polygamist or whatever you want to call it. No, their spouse died. Are they married any longer? No. Do they have a husband? No. When their spouse is dead, they don't have a husband. They're a widow. That's why we call them something different. They're not called a wife. They're called a widow. And in the same case, we call someone a widower. If his wife has died, does he any longer have a wife? Okay. Now, that's the argument. And that's where the debate is does that disqualify him from these qualifications? If you're going to look at it like that and just do the check mark, we've got a problem. But if we look at that in the sense of, is he bringing reproach upon the church? His whole life, has he been a one-woman man? Yes. Has he raised godly children? And if he was an elder before? Yes. And so these are questions we need to think about. And I'm not dismissing that argument. There is room for that debate to talk about what happens in that scenario. Okay? I'm not pretending to know all the answers. But what I'm asking us to do is to remember the context and what these qualifications are for in the first place. This is to help direct us to someone who is above reproach. And if someone's spouse dies and they remarry and no one has sinned, there is absolutely no reproach that's been brought upon the Lord's church. And that individual is still a one-woman man. He wasn't an adulterer. He isn't a polygamist. He's a man who exercised his right in the Lord after his spouse had died. John, go ahead.
This whole reasoning and what you're talking about also applies to every Christian in the congregation.
Right, right.
With their relationship to that local congregation. And if that congregation has elders and they become in a state where they can be classified as an heir or my mind is more blank. So I cannot speak. Mm-hmm. It's not a good example, is it?
Right.
Their relationship with the congregation has to be looked at, and that's what the Bible talks about. They can't be members of that congregation because
right.
Christ has severed himself from them.
Right.
These guys have got it right all their lives, and they're above reproach is the word I wanted. They're above reproach, just like a Christian needs to be above reproach all the time. You look at these men, and they're above reproach as Christians, and that's how we look at every one of ourselves.
Right. Good.
We all need to be above reproach.
Good. Wayne.
Just a quick thought that the focus on this gentleman who is above reproach, I don't know how to say this exactly, it's not really about him so much as it is when it says above reproach as God's steward.
Right.
Right. So it's that position he operates under as being a steward that really needs to
Right, right. And I really appreciate that focus again on the context, because this position, just like if you're voting for someone who's president or CEO, does that come with so much more responsibility? And that's why someone needs to be above reproach in those positions. And that's why the leaders of a church have got to be blameless in that sense. John. Right.
In order to be a Christian, he has to be above reproach. He can't afford not to be above reproach in regards to some of these things.
Right.
And these guys you talk about in Titus and Timothy, they've got it. It's
right.
Obvious.
Right.
Above
Right.
They're a full-grown Christian.
Because of the position of being a son of God. And the responsibility involved with that role that we've been given, that position, again, same thing. Good application. Yes. Right.
The solid need, and we don't teach other people and stuff. So it's all about maturity.
Right, right. And that's absolutely correct. And you see that language in the book of Hebrews a lot. That's right. All right, we're going to run out of time. That's okay. This next one is a tough one. And people debate about this all the time. The next qualification of a man who is above reproach is to be above reproach that his children are believers. The word there is faithful. And not open to the charge of debauchery or insubordination. In Timothy, it's put this way. He must manage his household well with all dignity, keeping his children submissive. Okay. Now, I want to make this point, and some disagree with me, and that's totally all right. That's why we all study. The emphasis here is not on the number of children. Do you see that? The emphasis is not on the number of children. The emphasis is on the spiritual state of those children. I'm of the personal opinion, and this is just my opinion, that a man who has one child who is absolutely faithful and dedicated to the Lord is not disqualified from this position. The word children is simply used here in the context to help explain that whatever children he has, they need to be faithful. Now, why do I come to that conclusion? Well, let's say, who in here has one child? Right, no, you do, okay? If I asked you if you had any children, and you said no, and then I find out about Jennifer, and I say, wait a second, you told me you don't have any children. And you said, no, we have a child, but we don't have children. Do you see that? How ridiculous that sounds? This is not a focus on the number. This is a focus on the spiritual state of those children, however many they be. This also explains that an elder's children must be old enough to obey the Lord from their own faith and their own conscience. Why can we come to that conclusion? Well, in Titus it says that the children are not open to the charge of debauchery or insubordination. The charge of debauchery literally means unsavedness. Or wastefulness. And the charge of insubordination is rebellion or not subject to rule. When's the last time that someone charged someone's four-year-old with unsavedness and insubordination? Maybe the sixth time they're being pulled out of the services, right? But no. This is an emphasis on the spiritual state of those children. For those children to be faithful, what do they themselves have to have? Faith. Someone cannot be faithful that is not old enough themselves to come to faith to the Lord. And this helps to give us an age range of men who are going to be elders in the Lord's church. Because someone who only has children, 10 and under, is not going to be someone who can be an elder of the Lord's church because his children have not yet demonstrated that they are faithful. And no one is going to bring a charge against them because they're still children. Okay, question. Go ahead.
So that one kind of strikes me because at the ages where they're a little younger, some people might say, well, they have one believing child and the rest are. That doesn't mean that you know that person that well. I mean, people hide things really well.
Right, okay. Now, here's what I hear her saying. Just because the kid comes to church doesn't necessarily mean he's faithful. All right? Does this take some investigation and some knowledge of each other more intimately?
Amen.
Go ahead.
Actually, you don't necessarily know that man.
Right, okay.
And the way that he's raised his children.
Okay.
How he treats them.
Okay.
Until they're older and they've had a chance to rebel.
Okay.
Say, I'm not
right. Right, okay. There needs to be something to judge the character of the father off of in the first place. Okay, go ahead.
I won't say names to protect the guilty, but when only
these men that she's referring to. And if full-grown men don't understand it, or full-grown women don't understand how their fellow members of the congregation are living out their lives until, well, I don't know why, but when elders, I guess preachers get the same effect on people. Preachers get to hear things and know things that nobody else in the congregation ever knows. And I found things out since I've become an elder that just floored me. I didn't know other people were having those problems and those issues and those difficulties in their life.
Right.
And what she said is very true.
Right.
So are you supposed to dig each other up? When the selection process is supposed to get that head,
let me respond.
That has destroyed congregations over the past.
Right.
And it's caused that back in that approach has disallowed eldership to be in some of the congregations. So you can't approach.
Okay. Good approach. Let me explain. When I say do some digging,
we're not
trying to dig dirt upon people. What I mean is that's not the way it should be, though.
Right.
We should be involved in each other's lives enough and confessing sins to one another and love each other enough and spend enough time with each other enough, there you go, that's the sentence I was trying to put together, to know whether there's something wrong or whether there's something right. Because we're really good at hiding things if we're only together an hour or two a week. But if we're actually together as the church as we should be, can you hide serious marital issues or serious parental issues from each other? And that's, so is that the way it is sometimes? Yes. Should it be that way? No. And that's how I would respond to that.
It is possible that the congregation is not ready to appoint the elders if they have to say, well, you know, we don't know these people yet.
Right.
These three men we've got for office.
Right.
And they may be correct.
Okay, good.
If they haven't known them at that point, they need to stop and get to know each other first before they even go to the office.
Good.
Process.
Wayne, then Annell, and then... Good,
is it
good
10,
question.
Is it 12? Is it 20 or 25? Joanne will even go as high as 30.
Right.
But and there is no science to that. There is no definite point. It's the generality that the writer is speaking to.
Right.
That we should be understanding. And
right.
I support that.
And I appreciate that comment. Yeah. Right.
As long as they're in the household, they probably will do exactly what we expect of them as a baptized teenager or whatever.
Right.
But everyone's a free moral agent, so after they get away, would be the proof of the pudding. Away from home, go to college, whatever.
And that's going to lead us into our next question. And we're going to cover this, and then we're going to stop. We'll do the rest of the qualifications next week. We'll just have to mold it into our material next week. Because this is important stuff. We need to take the time to talk about this. But that brings up the question, well, what does it necessarily mean believing children? Because what if a man has 5 children and 4 of them are faithful? Does that mean he's no longer qualified? Or what if 3 of them out of 5 or 2 of them out of 5? And you get these debates and these questions. And I don't know the answer to that question. Okay, let me be very transparent. I need to do a lot more study on this and thought on this, and I'd appreciate your feedback to me and your study on this in the future, and we'll talk about this more next week, but when you look at the scriptures, do rebellious children bring reproach upon their family and when you look in the Old Testament, upon the nation of Israel? And it doesn't necessarily matter how many, because David had a lot of sons. But did Absalom bring reproach upon a nation? Yes. And it brought reproach upon David. What about Jacob? He had some really good sons. Joseph, Benjamin. But did his sons bring reproach upon him? I mean, you look at what Reuben did with his father's concubine. You look at what Simeon and Levi did to the people at Shechem. You look at all these things. They brought reproach upon their father. He wasn't above reproach. When you look at Aaron, or Eli, all of their sons brought reproach upon the family and brought reproach upon Israel. And it was all of them in that sense. So this is a tough question. Jeff, and then Jeannie, and then we're done. Okay.
So an absolute being, you have to have more than one child. The word children there means actually singular or plural.
Right.
In the Greek. So like you gave the example with the Simmons, it's the same thing. If you have one child, you have a favorite children.
Right.
You use that qualification to go in. So while you are serving in, that qualification continues to follow you while you are in.
Okay. Good.
And so it's the same thing with absolutes when you say if you have five children, they all have to.
Right.
And that's where you can really kind of cross-check yourself a lot of times when you look at these scenarios or these hypothetical situations, if you will, that actually do become live. They're not always definite hypotheticals.
Right.
I think that's really the key. The point on qualifications, they're actually noun and verb, so they stand and fall together a lot of times. So they're post and present. They're going in and they're continuing quite far.
Right. And sometimes God's requirements and God's laws are very much absolute. But in some cases, like with these qualifications, we have to ask that question. Is drawing an absolute line on some of these things, is that what God's trying to say? And I really appreciate that comment. That's really good. Jeannie, and then we're out of time.
So during the presidential debate and stuff, they're looking at the children of
right.
these candidates also and saying, well, they don't talk to this child because of whatever.
Right.
So, I mean, even there, they're using their children.
Same criteria.
Yeah.
Right.
Exactly.
Right, right. And we'll talk about that, you know, next week is, you know, if a man's child turns 18, leaves the house and immediately falls away, maybe that's a demonstration and a sign that he wasn't managing his household well, but maybe a man who's been an elder for 10 years and his son falls away when he's 62, does that mean he's no longer qualified to be an elder? Those are tough questions, okay? Jeff, go ahead. Right.
So there are some absolutes.
Right. And I heard that.
Children,
I heard that.
The question is, was it singular or plural?
Exactly.
Yes and yes.
Yes.
And how many comes down to judgment of that situation.
Right.
People pick qualifications a lot of times at different ages of life.
Right.
I think Virgil Sidney became elder to like 36 and 38 years old.
Right. 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 Good. Good questions and good comments, everybody. Tough stuff, good stuff. We will talk about the rest of the qualifications and follow up on this next week and then lead into why elders are even being put up in Crete and the Jewish teachers at the time. All right. Thank you.